of the Union message. He sent for Biddle and told him in the presence of his closest advisers that he was planning to suspend freedom of speech for the duration of the war. The group watched impassively as Biddle, who was completely taken in, declaimed and declaimed against the idea, offering a vehement defense of civil liberties in wartime while pacing up and down. Biddle now understood the likelihood that the saboteur's case would come before the Supreme Court, and he welcomed the chance to argue it there. "We have to win in the Supreme Court, or there will be a hell of a mess," he told Roosevelt. "You're damn right there will be, Mr. Attorney General," Roosevelt replied with a grin. Biddle adopted an aggressive legal strategy that was aimed at making the conviction fast and sure, and keeping the courts out of the case. In lieu of a court-martial, which would have to follow rules dating back to the 18th century, he proposed creating a special military commission, which could set its own rules of procedure and impose the death penalty without requiring the unanimous agreement of its members. Roosevelt agreed. For good measure, Roosevelt's order declared that the saboteur's case could not be reviewed by any court. Over the protest of the War Department, Biddle chose to prosecute the case before the tribunal himself, so that he could appear before the Supreme Court if the defendants tried to reach that court. Following Roosevelt's lead, Biddle charged the men with violating the international laws of war by entering the United States without their uniforms. Then he added several other charges, including conspiracy to commit violent acts, which of course the saboteurs had not yet performed when they were caught. A special military commission needed special members. Biddle decided to ask Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, to sit on the commission as its chair. On June 29th, Stimson had dinner with Felix Frankfurter and asked his opinion on how to proceed. Stimson, easily the oldest person in the cabinet, owed his post to Frankfurter. Frankfurter had repaid the man who gave him his first government job by urging Roosevelt to bring Stimson into the cabinet for his second stint as Secretary of War, more than 20 years after his service under Taft. The argument had been that Stimson had the most relevant experience of any living American, and that he was a Republican, assuring bipartisanship. Even though he was now a justice of the Supreme Court, Frankfurter did not hold back from advising his old boss. He told Stimson that the Secretary of War should refuse to serve on the commission, which should be made up exclusively of military officers. A civilian serving on the commission would complicate matters when the time came for the administration to argue that the trial was a purely military matter and therefore beyond the reach of the courts. Frankfurter was advising a member of Roosevelt's cabinet about how Roosevelt could avoid the jurisdiction of the court on which Frankfurter sat. Judged by contemporary standards of non-communication between judges and the executive branch, Frankfurter's advice to Stimson was obviously improper. The saboteurs were almost sure to appeal to the Supreme Court, and Frankfurter had no plans to recuse himself if they did. It is anachronistic, however, to apply this standard to the Roosevelt Court. Roberts had been chosen to chair the sensitive Pearl Harbor Commission. Douglas and Jackson were intimates of Roosevelt, who attended regular poker evenings in the White House. Frankfurter himself was busily engaged in advising the president directly. There is little doubt that Frankfurter gave this advice simply because Stimson was asking for his opinion, and as a regular unofficial advisor to the president, Frankfurter was accustomed to giving it. There was, after all, a war on. The United States had been attacked, and now it had been infiltrated by men intent on destruction. For Frankfurter, the overarching goal of winning the war clearly took precedence over any nicety of the separation of powers or judicial impropriety. That the question was coming from his last living mentor guaranteed that he would make a useful response. Indeed, Frankfurter was not the only justice who became privately involved in the saboteur's case. After making the decision to go forward with the trial by military commission, a commission to be made up exclusively of generals, Roosevelt also ordered the appointment of defense counsel for the saboteurs. Two colonels in the Judge Advocate General's service were chosen. As part of the defense team, they in turn selected Major Lawson Stone, a lawyer who was the son of Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone. The defense team assigned Lawson Stone to research the question of whether a military tribunal was constitutionally permissible. He told them that it very possibly was not. The defense lawyers then concluded that their best bet was to go directly to the Supreme Court and seek an order declaring the entire idea of trial by military commission illegal. If they succeeded, the saboteurs would then have to be tried in an ordinary civilian court, which might help their case and certainly could do it no harm. Ordinarily, having settled on a legal strategy, the defense would have filed a motion stating its position. But this was no ordinary case. Instead of filing a motion, Kenneth Royal, one of the two colonels leading the defense, a North Carolinian trained at Harvard Law School, first contacted Hugo Black. Black told him, "I don't want to have anything to do with that matter." Royal then went to Justice Owen Roberts. Off the record, Royal asked Roberts if it might be possible for the Supreme Court to convene over the summer and hear the case on an expedited basis. Far from rebuffing this irregular procedure, Roberts invited the colonels to talk it over with him at his Pennsylvania farm, where he was spending the summer. Black, with whom Roberts then enjoyed a close relationship, would be there too. The men were to be joined by the Judge Advocate General, the Undersecretary of War, and Biddle. At this private conference at Roberts' farm, the justice served crackers, cheese, and fresh milk. Roberts and Black agreed to ask the rest of the court to convene a special session. With the agreement of Chief Justice Stone, the court decided to meet on July 29th. By then, the saboteurs' trial had proceeded to closing arguments. Its outcome was not in doubt. The intimacy between the judiciary and the executive branches, underscored by the cozy meeting at Roberts' farm, was further emphasized in the first moments of the hearing at the court. Stone noted that his son had been assigned to work for the defense and ceremonially offered to recuse himself. Attorney General Biddle, representing the government, not the saboteurs, answered that Lawson Stone had only worked on the defense of the military commission, not on the constitutional issues that were before the court, and that therefore the government did not seek Stone's recusal. This was partially true. Lawson had been removed from working on the constitutional issues as soon as it became clear there were any worth raising. But by contemporary standards, artificially dividing the defense's legal issues, as in a student moot court, would have absolutely no effect on the question of judicial recusal. This was, in fact, a kind of theater, in which roles were assigned and all had implicitly agreed to act them out. There was at least one extremely important precedent on the saboteurs' side of the case, a decision known as Ex parte Milligan, decided just after the Civil War. In it, the Supreme Court had held that a defendant charged with aiding the enemy could not be tried by a military commission in the state of Indiana while the civilian courts were open.